From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Friday, the 21st of February, 2020, and we have a good show lined up for you this morning from the State House in Montpelier. We're going to be talking first with Guy Page. He's a commentator on State House goings-on, has a couple of different publications. We'll let him listen for you and let you know where you can find them in just a moment. Steve Howard from the Vermont State Employees Association, he is the executive director of that state employees union, going to be stopping by and talking to us about some of the issues and et cetera going on with the state employees union in the second half hour of the program. A little bit later on, Xander Landon from E.T. Digger is going to be joining me to give another sort of journalistic overview of a wide range of issues happening here at the State House. We are fast approaching the midpoint of the legislative session. Next week, of course, the legislators are finish up on Friday before their mid-session break for town meeting day, just the a week from Tuesday. And we may have to punctuate the midpoint of the legislative session next week. Later on in the program after Xander, we're going to have a visit with Ann Donahue. She's a Republican state representative from Northfield, very active on issues with the state's mental health system over the years, a system which remains really in crisis in many respects. And we are going to be talking with Ann about some of the latest developments there, including a price tag attached to a planned hospital in Central Vermont at the Central Vermont Medical Center that appears to be way above what anybody was expecting. So let me welcome my first guest this morning. Guy Page joins me, and Guy, thank you very much for joining me.
Glad to be here, Dave.
And list for us your various publications. You do two or three things now.
Yes, I do.
I never can keep them all straight, but I'm sure you can. And tell us what they are and where they are and where people can find them.
Sure. I write a more or less daily column called the Vermont Daily Chronicle, just whatever strikes me as interesting, newsworthy from the State House. And also we publish twice a month a newspaper. That's, I don't know if you remember, Dave, the things that actually had made of paper that had words printed on them.
I do remember
those,
right. You could actually get ink on your fingers.
That's right.
Handling them,
That's right. So we publish one of those twice a month here. It's called the Chronicle of the Vermont State House, and we give them to legislators, we send them out to all the different municipal officials, we leave them around town, and basically we're covering the community of the State House. So it's about the people and about the issues and about the challenges and struggles here in the State House.
And you also have something called Vermont Water Cooler.
Yes, that's so much fun. Every day we find what we think are the 10 most interesting news stories in Vermont, and put them down there with their links, a little blurb from each one, and people get to sort of get the, here's the day's most interesting news in one email and one website.
And they link from there to the Valley News or the
The Chester Telegraph or the Newport Dispatch or the St. Albans Messenger or the Burlington Free Press or whoever.
So that's an interesting sort of news potpourri there. And talk to me a little bit about that. Are any of the publications, do they like having their stuff linked to like that, or are they worried about, you know, copyright or anything like that? Or
no one has complained yet. Okay. I ask myself that same question sometimes. I think that for a newspaper, anytime you get mentioned online and someone says, hey, there's an interesting thing in that paper, that's a good thing.
And if you provide a link to that paper's website, it drives traffic for them, I would think.
Definitely, yes.
So, I would not, if I were them, I would not complain. Now, do you have situations where you want a link somewhere, but then they have a paywall?
Yes. In fact, those papers, Valley News being a really good example, a terrific newspaper, very firm paywall. And so a lot of times I see a story, I want to put that in there. Oh, I can't put that in there. Caledonian Record is another one that's pretty tough to do that with.
Right. And I've sometimes wondered whether some of the papers would be wise to sort of join together and develop some kind of a consortium where you could have a certain number of months of a month of stories from any one of a selection of papers.
What a great idea.
And that way you wouldn't have just willy-nilly complete open access through the paywall, but you would have an ability to penetrate it on occasion or whatever.
And market it at the same time. That's a good idea.
So, anyway, we digress. I wanted to talk with you guys about some of the goings-on at the State House this week. I know you've been writing some about marijuana policy. We can talk about that in a minute. But what are some of the other issues you've been writing about this week?
Well, the Global Warming Solutions Act got voted out yesterday.
Passed the House.
That's right. Passed the House overwhelmingly with 107 votes, I think it was. That's about as veto-proof as it comes right there.
That's a strong vote.
And I got to say, that surprised me. I didn't think it would be that strong. There are so many potential pitfalls in that bill. That down the road, we Vermonters could be paying out a lot of money that they didn't know they would need to be because of this. And one of the things about this bill is that both Tim Briglin, the chair who sponsored it, and Speaker Mitzi Johnson both said, we need to do this because Vermont is suffering from global warming with storms and streams and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what is simply not recognized is no matter what we do here in Vermont to reduce our carbon, it's going to have very minimal effect on storms and that sort of thing. On the other hand, there are bills in the Senate right now, S-185, which talks about a resilience and adaptation and making our infrastructure stronger against extreme weather and against the effects of climate change. But there's almost no real interest in discussing that end of things. It's all on what I really think is a fixation on carbon reduction.
I know the argument that Vermont is such a small jurisdiction that it's gonna have a real difficult time actually having any significant physical influence on climate systems and atmospheric flows and so on.
It is global warming after all.
It's a global phenomenon, and yet if anybody is going to do something about this on a global basis. Isn't it the case that you kind of have to start somewhere?
I suppose so. Now, if you look at the latest UN report on how we're doing, came out a couple days ago, there are four projections that they have, four scenarios, and there's one that's the most optimistic, the most hopeful. Hey, we're doing really well. Last year, we were under that number in carbon emissions. So the world is actually doing a pretty good job already. Vermont's last numbers recorded were 2016. We are, for the first time, our emissions went down. And that was 2016. That was 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So one could argue that the $210 million we're already spending annually on global warming, that perhaps we're doing a pretty good job. And maybe we should be thinking about the carbon sequestration, you know, planting more trees, that there are ways to do this that don't, frankly, make poor people suffer the way that some of the proposals coming out in this legislature do.
And in what ways are poor people made to suffer?
Because if you have to pay twice as much tax on your heating oil to stay warm, and if you have to pay more for your gasoline to get to work in your car, which in rural Vermont means an all-wheel drive car, which means fairly low mileage, then that is putting a financial penalty and for some people an onerous burden on rural Vermont. And yet the people in Chittenden, the Climate Caucus, which is strongly Chittenden County, not only Chittenden County, but Chittenden and Washington County, they live on the interstate, and maybe the county's a bit wealthier. Frankly, the concerns of the Northeast Kingdom and other rural places are not maybe high in their list. We have a story coming out in next week's Chronicle of the Vermont State House, written by Job Tate, former representative, where he talks about 100 years ago, the political leadership in Vermont was so evenly distributed. It was only one party, but geographically, it was distributed all over the state. And he has little markers on a map. And you look at 100 years later now, it's very much focused on Chittenden and and Washington counties.
The that is an interesting piece of Vermont political history there. I remember in years past, there was always a discussion about east of the Greens versus west of the Greens.
Yes.
And that as a geographic marker, but...
Yes, they varied. They took turns.
Probably in the days before the before Interstates 91 and 89.
Definitely, and that is, it's all grouped to really around I-89. And also, when you had a one-party system back then, you could gain the system. So the Republicans who ran the state back then would say, okay, this year we're going to do west of the state. Next year the governor will be east of the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
So they could do that. Now it's a little messy. You can't do that.
It's those pesky Democrats keep interfering from time to time.
Yeah.
The planning process here. So what are some of the other topics you've been writing about this week, Guy?
Well, I got an interesting response, you might say, from a story I wrote on the money that financier George Soros has spent on some organizations that have been influencing Vermont's marijuana legalization effort.
Mm-hmm.
And he had given some money to the Marijuana Policy Project. I don't know that he's still a donor. He had been not too many years ago, and also is a large supporter of an organization that tracks what's happening in Vermont and reports out to the rest of the country. So I've got a very interesting response where I was accused of being anti-Semitic, which I didn't even know George Soros was Jewish. I guess he is. But apparently the background in this is that he has been accused that some truly anti-Semitic people have been sent him a pipe bomb or whatever, and have on the social media have accused him of being some sort of, you know, Illuminati, globalist, Jewish world leader, Protocols of Zion, all that sort of nonsense. And so there were people who were sensitive to that. I wrote something last night saying, first of all, there's no anti-Semitism involved, because I didn't even know he's Jewish. I will continue to write about how George Soros, to the extent that he's trying to influence the commercial cannabis debate in a way that is toxic to the minds of young Vermonters, I will continue to write about that.
Where does the funding come from for the other side in this debate?
I honestly don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Full disclosure, I used to be anti-legalization advocate of sorts, and there was a group called Physicians, Friends, and Families for a Better Vermont. It was basically, that's what it was. It was some doctors, some family members who had some issues with kids who were really hurt by marijuana, and they passed the hat among themselves, and the very, very small compensation I got was a result of that. That's all I really know about that. I do know there's an organization called Smart Approaches to Marijuana. It's a national organization, and where their funding comes from, I have no idea. Good question.
Yeah, I just wonder. Sometimes, if you're looking into, you know, doing the financial analysis on one side of the question, then balanced reporting would seem like you'd say, okay, I got to look at the other side of the question as well.
Yes, I think that's fair. No one has accused me of being anti anything for having done that. So that's what I was responding to.
We understand there is a big vote coming up on the minimum wage in the House on Tuesday. Guy, tell us about it.
Well, it is scheduled to come up, and it's been scheduled to come up before, in fact, I think Wednesday, and it did not get voted on because there weren't enough people here, and basically they didn't have all 100 votes that they need. The margin is that thin. When everyone is here, and if everyone votes the way that they hope they hope they will, they will get to 100 votes, which is what you need to override a veto. Problem is, not everyone is always here, so it's a pretty dicey thing whether it'll actually happen or not, because certainly they won't actually hold it unless they're sure. They're not going to risk another 99 vote on, like they did on paid family leave.
That can be a real disappointment to a lot of people when you attempt a veto override.
Yes.
And you don't get there.
Yes, there was some serious criticism and pushback of the leadership, some of it very public, right out on the floor, in fact. Cynthia Browning, who's sort of an independent Democrat, called out the speaker for her leadership on the overrides and other things as well, and there was some... that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah. Tempers can fray around here a little bit sometimes, and you do notice where occasionally intra-party rifts can develop. And
that's right.
But they don't usually play out on the floor.
No, that's, they don't.
That was an odd moment here in the Vermont House. But
one might say a revealing and interesting and honest moment as well. Yes, it does not happen very often, that's for sure.
Now, the minimum wage bill has been opposed by the governor, who vetoed it, obviously. And,
right.
And his argument is that it would be damaging to, especially to small businesses in rural parts of Vermont.
That's right.
How do you see that guy?
Sure. John Gannon of Wilmington, who's a Democrat and a vice chair of a committee, said that, look, if you had just an urban minimum wage, he could live with that. But the problem is that in rural areas, it just doesn't play. It has too much a negative effect on the urban economy. On the other side of that, there's the one Republican who's known to be voting for this is Paul Lefebvre of Newark, up in the Northeast Kingdom. And his argument is that he sees energy and the cost of food going up, those costs going up, no doubt driven in part by our energy policies. But in any event, he sees those costs going up and wages remaining flat. So as a way of keeping up with the inflation in those areas, it, to him, it seems like a necessity to do that, which for me, I respect his opinion. I look at the big picture there and I say, here's the state is intentionally trying to raise energy prices and then needs to compensate for that by artificially raising the wage. It's just a built-in, almost intentional inflationary act. I just sort of wonder why they're doing it that way.
It's interesting how you pass legislation which may have some downsides or unintended consequences or whatever, and then you pass other legislation which is designed, small part, big part, who knows exactly, to try to offset the first action. So
sure. And I'm not sure that when you say unintended for the raising the cost of energy, when you do a carbon tax because you want to reduce consumption of a certain product, that is intentional.
Okay, that's
they're trying to raise the cost of gasoline and heating oil. That's
true.
The point.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah. Now, in terms of the minimum wage law, though, in Vermont,
right.
People have been talking about a $15 an hour minimum wage. I mean, that was an issue in the 2016 presidential campaign.
Yep.
And now we're talking about a wage of $12.55 by 2022.
Right.
And that's a struggle. You know, the governor vetoes that. And I'm just wondering, if anybody looks at this picture and says, boy, we're really not making much progress here, or it's awfully slow, or whatever, what do you say to that person?
I'd say that the minimum wage has been going up, and it goes up with a cost of living, so that by 2022 it's going to be roughly $11.50 anyway. More to the point, the market in New Hampshire, where it's so much lower, people make more money.
Yeah. Well, hey, Guy Page, we're about out of time on this segment on the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. I want to thank you very much for coming by this morning.
Lots of fun.
And we will go to a brief break for some CBS News at the bottom of the hour here. A couple words from our sponsors, and when we return, we're going to be talking with Steve Howard of the Vermont State Employees Association. Stay with us, folks. We'll be back in a couple.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, blue cute to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We are back, continuing into the second half hour of our program on this Friday, February 21st, and we are joined on the telephone here by Steve Howard, the Executive Director of the Vermont State Employee Association. And Steve, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
And so talk to me a little bit about, I like to catch up every now and then with the State Employees Union, because you folks are obviously in the thick of many, many issues that come up here under the Golden Dome, and are you know, key players in the daily functioning of state government, obviously, and you are also a large part of the WDEV listening area here in Central Vermont, and so we like touching base with you from time to time. What are some of the key issues at play in the State House this legislative session for VSEA?
Well, we do have a number of efforts going on. I mean, one of the things that we are focused on intensely is trying to keep the Woodside Rehabilitation Facility for our juvenile offenders or juveniles open because of the high quality of care that our members provide these kids and the lack of a plan from the administration. We're working really hard to get the word out that Woodside is in the 99th percentile of programs across the country as rated by the Department of Justice for the quality of care that they provide for our young Vermonters who are experiencing trauma, who had a difficult adolescent time. And that's really as a result of the excellent care that our members provide. So we're working very hard to get that message out and to try to keep as much of that facility operating as possible and to oppose the administration's privatization plan, which we think is not well thought out and will leave huge gaps in the system for caring for some of the most vulnerable kids in the state.
The privatization plan, where is that? How far along is that in development? And are there expected to be key votes coming up for lawmakers this year, or is this something that's more more speculative at this point?
No, this will be voted on this year. I think there will be a juvenile justice bill in the Senate that will have language around Woodside. There's also language that will be in the state budget in the House and the Senate around how we, whether Woodside remains open or not. And that's, I think, a key issue. Our members are very concerned about the effect of closing Woodside. We've heard from social workers all across the state who are really afraid of it, law enforcement officers, who really think the administration has not thought this out at all, and that in the course of just a few months, they have completely flipped their position from investing in a more effective Woodside to one in which they throw up their hands, give up on these kids, and privatize the system. And we've seen this before. You know, this isn't something the state employees haven't seen before. You may recall, Dave, that right after Irene, our members recommended that we build a 53-bed state hospital for the mentally ill. And we basically, the administration at the time, the legislature, ignored those efforts by our members, the experts who are on the ground, who are with people every day. And it resulted in patients being lined up in emergency rooms all over the state because we hadn't built an adequate mental health system. We're concerned that for the youngest, for the trauma impacted kids in the state. The administration is repeating the same mistake. And it's for them all about money. For our members, it's about the kids.
When we talk about privatization of an organization like Woodside, first off, what's the population? What's the census at Woodside on a typical day or week or whatever?
Well, it really depends.
How many people do you care for them?
Now, the Department of Children and Families controls where kids go, and so they can artificially decide, you know, how they can subjectively decide how kids are placed and where they're placed. And, you know, a lot of states have an objective formula that they use. In Vermont, we don't do that. We allow politics to enter in. We allow the Department of Children and Families to manipulate that number. But last April, you know, Woodside had about 17 kids in that facility. In the spring, tends to be a busier time for that facility. What we don't know is, you know, where are these kids who need a secure facility going to go? And when you ask the administration, they say, well, we hope that this request for proposal from private entities will address that. We're not sure how that will go. And, you know, for that, for our members, that's not a good enough answer. We think our kids deserve a more thoughtful approach than what the administration has put forward.
Suppose some of our listeners out there right now are hearing this and they're saying to themselves, "This is just a union guy trying to protect his jobs." What would you say to that?
Well, our members have been very clear that they're not worried about their job. They have in fact proposed two alternatives that would reduce the number of positions at Woodside. What they're concerned about are the kids that they take care of, and those are the folks. You know, our members are the people who are every day in front of these kids. They're not courtroom cowboys. They're not advocates who show up at the state house and seem to know everything about Woodside. These are the people who are actually there every day. They're there 24 hours a day. They're providing this care to the kids. They are the ones who really know what these kids need. And what they're very concerned about is that the system that the administration sort of trying to put together with paper and glue, it looks like, you know, it's a messed up proposal, is not effective and is not going to address the needs of these kids. And I think we're hearing it from even the providers in the communities that are saying, these kids need to be in a facility like Woodside. We can't take these kids. We have seen this discussion before. It's exactly the same as what happened with the mental health system when the community was supposed to fill in the gaps for the state, and it failed miserably. And that's what our members are afraid we're about to repeat.
Is there any greater flexibility? I mean, is one of the attractions of a privatization plan that you can scale up and down quickly and easily and not be as worried about, union contracts and sort of a steady state government organization there? You see what I mean?
Yeah, I think really what privatization is about in many cases is, you know, these are tough situations. This is a tough area of responsibility for state government, and leaders who are not willing to take on those tough challenges just throw up their hands, give up on it, and say, we'll let the private sector take care of these kids. That's not consistent with the values of Vermont. It is tough to take care of kids who are in trauma, who are doing self-harm, who are hurting others. But we don't ship them out of state and give up on them, you know, wipe our hands of them. That's really what this proposal looks like, and it looks very much like what we did with the mentally ill. We sort of said, we'll let the community handle it. This is too hard for us. The state of Vermont should take on the challenges that are difficult for the people who need us the most, and that's what state employees do every single day, and they're fighting really hard on behalf of those kids, just as our members in the mental health system are fighting extremely hard on behalf of their patients.
In the mental health system, we obviously are watching the development and planning process for a new facility at the Central Vermont Medical Center in Berlin. Big headlines this week about the cost of it being way higher than anyone expected. Is there a little bit of Schadenfreude or something going on with some folks in VSCA over this?
Well, we predicted this. I mean, this is what this is what we said would happen. We told them that the system that they wanted to build was inadequate. And now they're having to come up with hundreds of millions of dollars. They would not be facing this question had they listened to the frontline experts who are on the floor of the state hospital who carried people through floodwaters. If they had listened to those people then, just as they should listen to the Woodside folks now, we wouldn't be at the mercy of the University of Vermont Medical Center and $150 million proposal. I don't know how many times the state can keep repeating this pattern of ignoring the frontline workers who have the best information, the most information, to make short-term decisions that in the end cost the taxpayers millions and millions of dollars. So BSC is not happy about the fact that UVM has come up with this huge price tag because it hurts Vermonters. We warned the legislature. We warned the governor at the time. And we're really most upset about is that nobody listened. And we hope that this mistake will not be repeated with Woodside.
The psychiatric facility, of course, in plan at the Central Vermont Hospital now is pushed back by a couple of years, apparently. Originally, the hope was to get something open by about 22. Now we're thinking 2024 as being an opening date for a new facility there. And meanwhile, what's the current condition people are going to have to continue dealing with?
Well, you know, we were supposed to have a temporary secure residential facility in Middlesex. It's been there almost 8 years, maybe longer. We face a $2 million fine from the federal government because of the lack of leadership on this front. And it really could have all been avoided had back in the day, the legislature and the governor at the time listened to state employees. And so I think we have people in temporary trailers that are not adequate for the care they need. There's not enough beds, step-down beds, clogging up the system. But this is what happens when you privatize services, when you rely on facilities that say they'll take the sickest patients and then don't. You know, the only institution or resource available when that happens is the state of Vermont. And that's why our state hospital has the sickest patients who take the most time to get well and who cost the most money and who are the most difficult, because that is the role of government. The private sector doesn't want to take care of those people. And that's what's happening with Woodside. You know, it's really the same discussion. And it's what we see now is everybody saying, well, the community programs can take them. But when they don't, where do those kids go? And the administration does not have an answer. And so we should really slow this train down. We should take our time. We should think through how to build a better Woodside, just as the administration proposed just a few months ago. The administration was insisting that they needed a facility like Woodside, pounding their fist on the table and insisting on it. And because of politics, they've completely abandoned these kids, and the union is fighting back and trying to keep this facility open for them.
So it feels like something of a change in direction then.
I'm sorry?
So it feels like quite a sharp change in direction then from the administration. Is that right?
It's a complete 180. They completely abandoned what was a very well-supported, well-thought-out proposal that they had last year to build a therapeutic facility that was more appropriate to the kind of care that those kids at Woodside needed. It was something that the union and the administration were working hand-in-hand to get done. And because, you know, it is expensive. It is an investment in our kids. This new administration, this new secretary, completely within a matter of weeks, flipped their decision and walked away from the kids who would have benefited from a significant investment in infrastructure for our most vulnerable youth. It's really sad to see that this has happened, that money is taking precedent over what the kids in the state need. But that's what's happening. And we're not going to just sit idly by and let them do this. I mean, we may not win, but we're going to fight like crazy and hope that we can, because these kids are counting on us.
Steve, I want to check in with you and just find out where various contracts are in the current in our current cycle of contracts. I understand we are not the general, the largest contract is not up, but there are a couple that are.
Yes, so we are in the midst of bargaining for our members who work in the judiciary and for our members who are the clerical and technical workers at in the state college system in the state. And we're about to begin bargaining with our newest unit, which is the Office of State's Attorneys all across the state. So those are the three areas that are the most active. And, you know, I have to say that the judiciary, people would be shocked to see how the management of the judiciary treats its employees and how they're almost disrespectful of their lack of support for collective bargaining. And it's really, it's been very sad to see that mostly women who make up the 200 employees we represent are treated by management. Collective bargaining is seen by the management of the judiciary as sort of an afterthought. And we're going to try to change that this year. We have some legislation pending that would change the way we bargain with the judiciary in order to hold the management more accountable, get them to take collective bargaining seriously, and to improve the working conditions and raise the wages for these members who are paid. Really, people would be shocked to see how poorly they are paid for the amount of work that they do and the important work that they do in the judiciary.
How many people are there working in the judiciary who are covered by the union?
About 200.
And you said there, so we're, I'm thinking now of mainly like court clerk's offices and so on, right?
Well, if in any courthouse you go, you have docket clerks, you have court officers, you have folks who work in the family court who are case managers who, you know, helps try to move some of the family court cases along. There's a fairly sizable number of folks. Mostly they're women, and they're not treated well for the importance of access to justice and the importance of the judicial system. The management there really does not take collective bargaining seriously. They're somewhat punitive in the way they treat the employees there. I think the people of Vermont would be really, I think, pretty upset if they understood the full story there.
What are some examples of the way in which you feel as though these unionized members, workers in the judicial system are being sort of shortchanged or not treated very well?
Well, there's a couple of really key examples. The first one is in collective bargaining. When you have a union, you have power at the bargaining table with the boss, and you're equal with the boss at the table. So you have proposals that go back and forth. This the leadership of this judiciary refuses to have any serious discussion about economic issues with our members until the legislature has determined what money they will spend. And they say, well, you're just going to get what the executive got. You're not going to be able to have a give and take back and forth in the normal course of bargaining that every other bargaining unit in the state gets. It's a way of trying to say, we don't really want to bargain with you. You're just going to get whatever. We're going to wait so long in the process, you're going to get just whatever the executive got. Even if that's not what you proposed at the bargaining table. It's disrespectful, and we are going to try to change that process so that our members have more power, and hopefully that will get the chief administrative officer of the judiciary to take collective bargaining more seriously. The second
give me a sense of the calendar here. When is the contract up, or what's the deadline?
It ends at the end of the fiscal year. You know, we reached an agreement with the executive before the legislature even came back in January. Mm-hmm. And the judiciary tried, our members of the judiciary sat down around the same time as the executive branch units and tried to have a negotiating process that was fair and equal with their managers, and the judiciary said we're not going to come to the table with any economic proposals until maybe March, which is almost halfway through the legislative session and really late in the process. And so it's a way of saying, hey, we're not going to treat you with respect. We're not going to take you seriously, and we're not even going to try to get to a negotiated settlement that might be different than what the executive has.
And the And the other contract that is coming is currently under bargaining. What is it?
So there's two. There's the state colleges. We represent the administrative and custodial staff all across our state college campuses, and they've just begun bargaining. And the other one is the Office of State's Attorneys, which we just organized.
Oh, State's Attorneys.
So they'll be negotiating their first contract.
Yeah, that's another whole kettle of fish. I suppose. Well, we might have to save that for another segment on the Dave Graham Show here at WDEV FM and AM, in part because we are about out of time on this segment. But Steve Howard, Executive Director of the Vermont State Employees Association, I want to thank you very much for joining me. It's always good talking with you. Let's do it again soon.
Thank you very much.
All righty. Hey, we are going to go to some top of the hour news from CBS. A couple words from our sponsors. We'll be talking with Bob May after the top of the hour break, and then a little later on with Xander Landon of ETDigger.org. Don't forget about the podcast, WDEVradio.com. Follow the link to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit, and you'll come up with a list of our recent programs, and you can listen any time of day or night thanks to the Warren Store and our sponsor of our podcast. We'll be back in a few minutes, folks. Stay with us.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
Thank you for staying with us into the second hour of our program on this Friday morning, February 21st, 2020, and we are broadcasting live from the State House in Montpelier, as we like to do on Friday mornings during the legislative session. And we'll be getting back to Xander Landon of ETDigger.org in just a few minutes to talk with him about what he's been seeing and hearing around the State House this week. He's a State House reporter for that excellent online news organization. But first, we wanted to go to Bob Ney, one of our national correspondents, to fill us in on some of the big stories that have been unfolding in Washington and elsewhere. Good morning, Bob. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Dave.
And I see the headline. It looks like Afghanistan. Are we really going to have a deal this time?
Well, this is in the works, but let me just try to real quickly explain a couple of things on this. We are getting a 7-day, I'm not going to say ceasefire, but a downplaying of violence is basically how it's kind of worded. And that's a 7-day from the Taliban. And then we sign then after that an agreement with them. We don't know all the terms of the agreement. After that is signed between the United States and the Taliban, then the Taliban begin talking with intra-governmental communications for peace, and that would be with the Afghan government. We've also got warlords over there. I guess you compare it to the mob, okay? If we had to put in terms over here, we'd understand. So it's happening, but I think there's a long, old road to hoe here. I've been in Afghanistan twice, and it's just a country very, very in turmoil all the time.
Yeah, and seems like it has been forever, you know, through the British, sure, and then the Russians, and then the United States trying to tame it and apparently failing, really. And is this going to be a path to the U.S. extracting itself at this point?
Well, you've asked the right question. I think it's a path to us extracting ourselves, but I don't know what that means of the future of Afghanistan. Until the Afghan government gets stronger and more capable, the Taliban is still fairly strong, and the warlords are strong. And then also the issue nobody ever likes to talk about, but there's the opium fields over there, and who controls those opium fields and all of that money and of course grief that comes in chaos from all the heroin that's distributed around the world.
Yeah, it's a mess. And
it is.
It seems like it's much less of a mess than it was 20 years ago before, right, the United States went in. So
yes, that's true.
Hey, interesting domestic political developments yesterday with the sentencing of Roger Stone, the longtime aide to President Trump. He got a little less than it was initially expected, and do you think that that is that's good enough for the president, or is the president still unhappy?
I think the president still is mildly unhappy. It's very interesting. I don't believe that whole brouhaha where the president, you know, tweeted and then the Justice Department changed his position with the federal court. I don't believe that had any bearing on the judge at all. I really don't. Because I think the judge was going to give Roger Stone what the judge was going to give Roger Stone. And Roger Stone did everything to irritate that judge, so he's kind of lucky that the judge is you know, like that. Sentences could go up or down. My plea deal was 18 months. The judge gave me 30. The government was asking for 9 years, then they were changing their mind. And again, I think in this Roger Stone case, the judge still gave what the judge was going to give. But, you know, who knows? I mean, some say the president was building a white-collar, you know, case of who he pardoned, et cetera, in order to eventually pardon or commute the sentence of Stone, which I don't imagine will be done before the election.
I have heard that, for instance, the pardon this week of former Governor Blagojevich of Illinois was kind of basically a matter of, I don't know, just, you know, chopping up the soil before you plant the seed of a Stone pardon. Mm-hmm. So that is, and other pardons as well. I mean, Trump is developing a long list of people he might wish to pardon. At
correct.
Some point or another, so it is a it's quite an enterprise. I've noticed. I've tried to keep track. I think we were up to 27 criminal convictions for this campaign and administration of this president as of mid-November, with the 7 for Roger Stone, and I think that puts him about on pace with the Nixon administration, if I recall the numbers correctly. So
yeah, because usually this happens kind of in the second term, but in this case it was the first term that the connections got in trouble.
Of course, meanwhile, the Democratic debates and so on are roiling along here. Nevada caucuses tomorrow. The polling seems to indicate that Sanders is still on top out there.
Yes, it does. I mean, there was no question that Elizabeth Warren had Mike Bloomberg for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and dessert up on the stage there. One of my friends, he's progressive, he has a radio show, I was on it, and he said she politically punched him. I said, no, she politically took a machete to him. It was not a political punch. I mean, she just very, with great skill, just laid out some items that Bloomberg just can't get around. And then other people, Dave, I'm talking about the Democratic side, by the way, have said to me, well, what does it matter of Bloomberg versus Trump when it comes to these women, you know, and undisclosed, you know, agreements? I said, that's not the point. Bloomberg has to get through a Democratic primary, and those things are not going to be well received by most Democratic constituencies. Just not going to happen.
Yeah, I think that Bloomberg is basically toast at this point.
I do too. I really do. Now Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden really have to come out of decently out of at least South Carolina, then Super Tuesday, in order to kind of stay in there. But Bernie, right now, if you look statistically, Dave, is if he continues and if Bloomberg can't, you know, sink him with money, then I think Bernie continues to stay ahead of the curve and just gather delegates as he moves along.
Although it was an interesting round of questions at the end of the debate on Wednesday night, where the question was, do you support the idea that the person with the most delegates when we get to the convention should be the nominee? only one of the six said yes to that.
Exactly.
Breakdown of answers there. My concern for the Democrats is that if in fact they figure out a way to deny Sanders, you know, if he goes into the convention with the most delegates and they figure out a way to deny him, boy, is that going to be that's going to be really damaging.
If that happens, Donald Trump will win. I'll predict to you today with about 55% of the vote, because a lot of people are going to stay home.
Yeah, I really, I think, I'm trying to figure out, If the Democrats can ever reconcile themselves to Sanders and figure out, you know, that in fact there is a that, you know, do you think they ever could get to a place where they can kind of say to themselves, we can live with this guy?
Well, a lot of people in the mainstream Democratic movement, I'm not talking about people out in the hinterland, I'm talking about the lobbyists and the money people, right? I mean, they don't want Bernie Sanders, period. They just don't want him.
Yeah.
And that filters through with the social media, and you get, you know, people saying things. And then you still have some Hillary Clinton people that just are so angry at Bernie Sanders because they say that he cost her, you know, the election, which I personally don't believe, but they say that. And so, therefore, they're hanging around out there. So it depends the attitude after this Democratic convention is over with. The attitude is going to be the most critical for the Democratic Party in the last, I think, 30 to 40 years as to what they do. Now, if we go to that one question you just asked, if they deny Bernie Sanders, who legitimately will have enough delegates at that time, hypothetically, right? If they mm-hmm. deny him, then it's over with. I mean, they cannot recover from that kind of internal explosion.
Yeah, I think it would be kind of suicidal for the Democratic Party at that point, and I'm not sure whether the party can really. I mean, I suppose it almost has to recover just because there's still enough energy, you know, center-left energy politically in the country that you know, there has to be a counterweight to the Republican Party,
right,
of some kind. But I don't know. I think it would be a really, really tough situation for the Democrats. And is there anything that Sanders can do to try to, you know, I mean, I of course, I'm up here in Vermont. I know a lot of people who really like Bernie Sanders and are cheering him on. And they would probably, you know, kill me for even suggesting this. But is there anything he can do to lessen the fears of these other Democrats out there about what he's planning?
Well, I mean, he can't reverse himself backwards off positions. You know, that's the benefit of Bernie. What you see is what you get. But I think what he can, you know, convince them is that, you know, he if he's got support, he is viable to Trump. And I'll tell you another reason why. If you look at how this would run between Sanders and Trump, you know, Trump can fill a stadium, right? So can mm-hmm. Sanders. Mike Bloomberg can't. Mike Bloomberg just spent over $100 million, right? And Bernie is still doubling the amount of people that are interacting over Bernie Sanders. Think about that.
And that
doubling Bloomberg.
And I was watching Bloomberg the other night in the debate, and I said to myself, this is probably the most expensive evening anybody has ever had.
Well, yeah, and look, he was rolling his eyes and snarky. You know, that may sell in New York City if you're the mayor. And you might get away with it. You're not going to get away with it on a national stage.
No. He was really weak, and I thought
horrible.
I thought his answers on stop and frisk. I mean, he had to know that was coming, and the idea that he wasn't able to get a little more beneath the surface, and that's right where Elizabeth Warren went. To say, you know, to say you're sorry about the way it turned out is not sufficient. It was the intent going in. I think she really scored with that particular line of questioning and left him just completely flustered.
Well,
and then
absolutely.
And then the thing about how he couldn't agree to a release on the non-disclosure agreements right there. Again, should he have seen that coming? I don't know. I mean, it seems like if he was smart and had smart people around him, he would have.
He should have. You know, I had a friend of mine who was really big on Bloomberg, and I said to him, do you know about the following four things? And he said, no. And I said, well, I'm not some, you know, super sleuth. Everybody in politics knows about this, and on stage they're going to go after him. And sure enough, my friend called me back. He's like, he didn't even answer the stuff correctly, and he didn't. And on stop and frisk, he said, I stopped it. He stopped it because the judge told him to.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, I found his whole performance, frankly, just appallingly bad. But on the other hand, I thought it was helpful to have him in a forum where his money doesn't make any difference. I mean,
right.
You know,
correct.
He wasn't... if he's just buying ads, he can script them exactly as he wants,
sure.
obviously. And I think it's kind of disturbing to see that when you have a campaign that is probably the purest example yet of a campaign built really just on advertising, how many points that can move the polls.
Oh, it can. I mean, you're correct. It just moved them. Then when you see the product, you say, well, wait a minute, you know. And then after, but, you know, Bernie Sanders has through grassroots, has Elizabeth Warren and Buttigieg. You know, those candidates have, they've been in this for a while. They've been out there in the fields, you know.
Yep. Let's see. Do we have a listener calling in? Did I hear that?
Yeah, it's Brent.
Oh, okay. Bob, do you have a minute to take a call from a listener?
Sure. Right.
Let's go to Fred in Newbury. Good morning, Fred.
I got a question for you guys. If we have states that have open primaries, I'm predicting there's going to be a lot of crossover votes for Bernie. So Bernie will get the nomination, and then of course he'll lose the general election. And so the people are going to do the crossover are figuring Bernie's going to be the weakest candidate, and so that's why they'll vote for him.
Crossover states, I mean, what the caller is saying is possible. It's happened before. I've seen it happen in primaries where they will cross over a large amount of Republicans or Democrats will cross over to pick a certain candidate that they think is going to be weaker.
Right.
I mean, it could happen, you know, but then again, of course, it's all speculative of who thinks the weakest candidate is there. I mean, personally, if I was looking at this election, I think, well, Bloomberg has the money, but I still think he's a weak, you know, candidate. Although, again, to be fair about this, if they want to bring up about women, Bloomberg doesn't have to really defend himself too much against Trump. So, you know, that's the other way to look at this.
Yeah, I
guess.
I think on the other hand, I think a lot of Democrats would be looking at that and saying, we wanted something distinct from distinct from Trump, Trump than Bloomberg.
Yeah, I think most in the crossover states, most people will hold to their party. But what the caller talks about is important because if enough crossover in certain cases, I mean, this whole election is going to boil down to tight numbers with groups of people. It's just going to be like a jigsaw puzzle. This isn't so clear as well. Donald Trump's finished. He's not. And
yeah,
so this is going to be a piecing together by the Democratic side of a lot of components to make some kind of unity with the candidate.
One last thought here, and I suspect you probably have to move on to your next call, Bob,
pretty soon.
But I want to make the point that here in Vermont, Bernie Sanders has a long history of attracting votes from, frankly, quite conservative parts of the state. Places you typically vote Republican in most contests, and he picks up a lot of votes there, and I think some of it is kind of a working class sensibility that goes beyond party politics and that sort of thing. I wonder if that has any, whether that could actually have some draw nationally, you know, in the general election if he does get the nomination, and whether Democrats can be given any comfort by the idea that, you know, your nomination of Bernie Sanders does not automatically, you know, throw him to the wolves for defeat by Donald Trump, because there are going to be some people who voted for Trump in 16 who will cross over and vote for Bernie in 20.
Well, I think that the Democratic side has a lot of possibilities. Look, when you look at the Democratic candidates, you have Bernie Sanders, who, you know, we can look at all the downsides that he's, quote, a Democratic socialist, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. But in reality, you know, people here, we have Medicaid, Medicare, we have housing. People are kind of used to, you know, government intervention, right? So you have that. And then you have Elizabeth Warren, and I'm not sure what all the downsides would be. Some people actually say, well, she's just too far left of Bernie and wants to spend, you know, too much money, et cetera, et cetera. And then you've got Mayor Buttigieg, who some of my Democratic friends tell me they worry about having a gay guy at the top of the ticket. But, I mean, each candidate, I guess you could look and say, well, that's not the right one, that's not the right one. So, you know, who is the right one? And I still think with all the flaws of the candidates, with the exception of Bloomberg, I guess I might sound really biased, But I think all the other candidates could stand a chance against Trump if there was unity behind him. Maybe Bloomberg could too, I guess. You know, have to give that. I just don't see a lot of Democrats on Bloomberg saying, "Oh, you know, let's just let Trump destroy further the Republican Party, and we'll just have at it next time." You know.
All right. Well, speaking of having at it next time, let's do that, Bob, in a future conversation. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning. Always good chatting with you. Bob Ney, one of our national correspondents. I wanted to give another listener a crack at us. Marcia from Barry's on the line. Good morning, Marcia.
Hi, morning, Dave. I had some comments about your discussion with
Bob Ney?
Yeah, with Bob, and about Bernie and all the propaganda that's against him. I don't understand all the fear against Bernie matching up against Trump. All of the matchup polls have shown him either the highest or extremely high to win over Trump, and plus his backstory, which he's not telling, but which is out there, is so compelling about members of his extended family who have fought against white supremacists, and just an enormous amount of stuff that would be even more compelling if he'd allow it in, and it's just extremely frustrating to watch all the propaganda fed fear around him, and it's aggravating. But Bernie is going to be on 60 Minutes this Sunday night in an interview with Anderson Cooper, so that might be very telling.
Worth tuning in for sure.
All right. Thanks.
Marcia, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. All righty. I wanted to bring in my next guest. Xander Landon is a reporter covering the State House with VTDigger.org. And Xander, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Dave.
And talk to me a little bit about some of the issues at play here in the State House. I understand there's going to be a crucial House vote on Tuesday now. They're scheduled for on minimum wage.
Yep. So this is a bill that has been making its way through the State House, arguably for the last 4 years or so. There's been a big push to increase the minimum wage. At first, it was a $15 minimum wage, and now it's a $12.55 minimum wage, which we would see if this bill was enacted in 2022. That bill was vetoed last week by Governor Scott, who had concerns and has had concerns about how a minimum wage increase could affect the small business community and more rural parts of the state. And the Senate was able to override that veto very easily last week, and now the House is trying to whip votes and get to the 100 votes they need to override the governor's veto pen and make sure that this becomes law. However, it's going to be a pretty tough task for them, and it's we already saw a veto override attempt fail in the House on paid family leave earlier this year. There are a lot of Democrats in the House who share concerns about what a mandated wage increase would do to the economy, and they don't want to see it. And there are definitely it's definitely going to be a tough task for them in the coming days to get those votes together.
How bad would it be for House Democratic leadership if they lost a second veto override vote in a row like this?
I think it would be a problem for them in the sense that this issue and the paid family leave bill are two issues that they sort of campaigned on and have touted as their top priorities in the last few years. They've already, failed in the last biennium to pass these items because the governor vetoed them and they couldn't get the support they need to override him. It definitely would be a big loss for the Democratic Party in the state, and a big win for the Republican governor.
Yeah, that is for sure. I mean, I'm sure that it would become a campaign issue in the gubernatorial race, but we'd have to see how big an impact it had.
And it's interesting because Phil Scott, despite vetoing these bills, which are
big priorities, and according to polling, the majority of the...
We actually need to go to a...
Yeah, we can come back and talk about this after.
Bottom of the hour break with some CBS news, but want to have folks stay with us, because Xander Lynn is my guest. We're going to talk more about minimum wage and other issues on the other side of the break. We'll be back shortly, folks.
As the winter rolls on, we're on sale upstairs at the Warren Store. All fall winter clothing is 20 and 25% off. Cozy tops, comfy bottoms, warm coats and jackets for men and women. Cool, Prana, Smartwool, Save the Duck, Kari Tra long underwear. Need a hat? We have Skeeta, Shukas, Papia, and more. Palms and beanies galore. And a large selection of socks from fun to functional, Blue Q to darn tough. Spring clothing is arriving, so come on down for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. The almost world-famous Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV FM and AM.
We're back. My guest is Xander Landon, the State House reporter with VTDigger.org. And Xander, we were talking about the minimum wage legislation, which comes up for a veto override vote on Tuesday, and just kind of what the political stakes are for the Democratic Party in particular in Vermont and in the their legislative majority. I mean, I don't think their legislative majority goes away anytime soon. But it's got to be a little bit on the crushing side if yet another veto override fails, wouldn't you say?
I think it will be to a large extent. But at the same time, I mean, I think that, you know, what the House Speaker has said in reaction to this, the first time that the veto override failed, which was on the paid family leave bill, she said, you know, I think me and other reporters were asking her, well, you know, why did this happen? And she sort of pointed to the few independent and moderate-leaning Democrats who didn't come around on the override vote and voted against the paid family leave legislation on the floor, and said it's really up to voters to consider whether they believe that these people should still be in office. Mm-hmm. So it may be, you know, an approach, you know, that, you know, coming out of these votes, if we see minimum wage take a similar turn, we see that fail because they can't get some of these more moderate Democrats to come around and support an override, you may be seeing more of that rhetoric and the party focusing, I guess, both on the Republican governor, Phil Scott, and also on these more moderate Democrats who are, in some ways, holding party leadership back on its priorities.
Will the party leadership be running other people against them, do you think, or what's
that? I think I asked that question at the time, and that wasn't so much, you know, what they were communicating directly, mm-hmm. but, you know, maybe the party will attempt to do that. And as you suggested, that this would become a campaign issue in the gubernatorial race.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting about that is that, you know, there's some recent polling that came out on Monday from Vermont PBS and VPR, and that polling showed these issues, minimum wage and paid family leave, a majority of Vermonters really want those to be enacted. But at the same time, they really support Phil Scott, the governor. He has a very big approval rating, and a lot of Democrats, I think a majority of Democrats, approve of his performance in office. So Phil Scott, even though he's vetoing major Democratic priorities that Democrats are sort of getting elected on, minimum wage, paid family leave in particular, even though he's standing in the way of those becoming law, he still retains the support of the voters that also vote in Democrats. So that's a big problem for the party, and it's going to be hard, you know, and it has been hard to message that you know, effectively, because it seems kind of to be the case that those, him standing in the way of those priorities, aren't enough to get people, Democrats, to vote against him.
So we love this governor, we just don't like what he does, is that it?
I don't know if that's what this if that's what the polling shows, but it does show that
some kind of a strange alchemy going on there.
You know, I mean, you know, one thing that I've heard talking to voters when, I think during the last election cycle, is that people have said, and, you know, this is a small sample size, but I think it's representative and maybe part of the reason why people vote for Phil Scott and a Democratic legislature, people have said that they really like divided government. They like having they don't like the if they can avoid it, single party control in the state. Maybe that's just sort of a fluctuation. Maybe that's just because we recently saw one party control of the governor's office in the legislature when Peter Shumlin was governor, and people were sort of ready for a change.
So if there's a pattern that starts to develop of Democrats in particular who are in control of both houses of the legislature coming up with quite progressive seeming legislation that then gets vetoed by the governor, maybe the next thing down that pipeline could be something like, I don't know, the Global Warming Solutions Act?
You mean as a way to sort of...
more veto bait, basically.
More veto bait. Well, yeah, and it's clear that Governor Scott is not too keen on this proposal.
This is a bill that was just voted, passed easily in the House yesterday.
Yep.
And it's heading over to the Senate, and the Senate rarely takes a path to the right of where the House is on anything. And so looks like this is going to be in some form heading to the governor's desk. The governor's been expressing big misgivings. It just seems like I've seen this movie before.
Yeah, and, you know, Democrats will say, well, we're not going to legislate according to the governor's agenda and, you know, climate change. Related, doing something big on climate change was clearly something that the Democrats in the State House were going to do this year, given sort of, you know, the sense of urgency that a lot of Democratic voters have brought to the table and are demanding of their elected officials. This bill would mandate the state to hit emissions reductions levels over the coming decades, and the governor's concerned about, you know, the potential for lawsuits, because this would allow people to sue the state if those emissions goals aren't met. And he's also concerned about basically making this a requirement for the state before there's basically a plan explicitly written out and approved. This would basically make the executive branch give them the task of figuring out how to get to these emissions reductions, but doesn't explain or spell out exactly how you get there. And that's another point of concern for him. He has, you know, to sort of spare the details, he has supported or signaled that he could support maybe a more moderate version of this, where the lawsuits can't come forward as quickly as they would under the Democratic version of the bill.
Yeah.
But I think that it's very likely that he would, you know, if the current form of this reached his desk, that he would veto the bill. Mm-hmm. And it would be an opportunity for Democrats to point at the governor and say, you know, look, you've elected someone who's not supporting us on climate change, which is a pressing issue at this time.
Or minimum wage or paid family.
As we've seen, you know, those aren't necessarily enough. Him vetoing those and Democrats using those as talking points aren't necessarily enough for them to get.
So the theory is there's a straw eventually that breaks the camel's back, so to speak, or
I don't know if they're calculating exactly, you know, what's it going to take? How many more vetoes do we need to put on the scale to tip it in our favor? But I think that that's part of the strategy, as it probably would be in any, you know, election year, to say, look, we're trying to get things done, but this governor is standing in our way.
The governor, from his point of view, is he's just basically trying to defend the economic interests of the average Vermonter. I mean, that's what his pitch is, and it seems to be selling so far, at least if you look at the poll results.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I don't think that the people that elected the governor would be shocked at what he's doing here.
That's true, too.
I mean, people put Phil Scott in office to sort of ward off against increases in the cost of living, increases in taxes, fees, and government mandates to some extent, right? So, or new government mandates. And
he's the break against the Democratic accelerator in the legislature.
Right. So if some Democrats are crossing over and voting for him because, you know, they wanted sort of a change in pace, you know, I think that they probably did that knowing that he would stand in the way of some of these big Democratic priorities, and maybe that's something that they want to see. Maybe they want to pump the brakes a little bit. And so at some point, you know, maybe the tides change and people want to see what they saw 4 years ago, 6 years ago again. But
mm-hmm. All right. Well, Xander Landon, vtdigger.org, thank you very much for stopping by and sharing some of your insights this morning. It's always good talking with you.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
My next and last guest of the program today is Ann Donahue. She's a state representative from Northfield, Republican, longtime rep here now. Ann, how many terms have you been in the legislature?
I think this is the 17th year.
Wow, okay. So you are getting to be a veteran around here.
Right.
And longtime involved in the state's mental health system issues connected there, too. You've been on various House committees, health care, human services. Have you done a stint on institutions? I'm trying to remember.
I haven't. I was on the Joint Oversight Committee for mental health.
For
several years.
Okay. So you've been very involved in these issues for a number of years now, and some really important and key insights into the functioning of the mental health system in Vermont. You're kind of a go-to person, I think, for a lot of folks like me in the media over the years, and I appreciate your role and always your willingness to share with us what's going on. And this week there was a very interesting story in vtdigger.org about the planned psychiatric unit at the Central Vermont Medical Center in Berlin. The story indicated that there was a plan drawn up with a proposed price tag of $150 million, which has left some people sort of wagging their tongues in shock or something. Kevin Mullen, the chair of the Green Mountain Care Board, called the plan disturbing because of the high price tag. I think Morning Fox, the mental health commissioner, said something to the effect that the typical cost for a psychiatric bed in any kind of an institution is about $1 million per. This is a 25-bed facility that's been contemplated. So I do the math and I say that should be about a $25 million price tag. The price tag we heard this week was $150 million. That is off by a factor of six. So we're trying to figure out what the heck's going on. Ann Donahue, what the heck's going on?
That was well stated, and certainly, actually, $1 million a bed, unfortunately, is about the cost of any hospital inpatient bed these mm-hmm. days.
Wow.
So $25 million sounds like what it should be. But there's a lot more to this story than that. I think, first of all, everyone recognizes the urgent need for this project to move forward. It's a disappointment to have a delay. It's urgent for a lot of reasons, the need for care, but also because of the real urgency of phasing out the Brattleboro Retreat, which is not able to provide quality care in the current institution there. It's a very antiquated model. At the same time, we have to recognize nobody wants short-sighted planning to happen. Mm-hmm. Pop up a building and then work out how everything else works afterwards. At the time that it committed to doing this project, Central Vermont Medical Center was also working on its campus master plan for the future. They need a new emergency department. They need new inpatient beds. Things transition after 25, 30, 40 years of use.
Mm-hmm.
So that as and I helped with this process, other stakeholders did, so I really followed it and understood the logic for it and supported it, that really the best way to combine the master plan needs with the new inpatient beds was to make the emergency department the base of a new inpatient tower that would begin with the two levels of psychiatric beds and then be capable of adding replacement inpatient units from the hospital as part of that long-term master plan.
So this building would actually be emergency department on the ground floor.
That's right.
Floor just above the ground floor and the floor just above that, so the, I guess, second and third floors, would be a psychiatric unit?
Precisely.
And then there would be more floors above that for general population inpatient hospital care?
That's right, other inpatient uses. Over time, not all built at once, but constructed so that it could accommodate that future need as well.
Hmm.
And that's what drove the cost. It wasn't that they were planning, you know, luxury inpatient suites. But doing it the best way, which I truly believe this was, the price tag did start increasing. It wasn't just an emergency department renovation, as some of the versions said. It was an entire new emergency department. And the only location on relatively small campus that made sense ended up, it would have bumped a whole lot of current parking. So this idea of also needing a parking garage wasn't some luxury add-on. It would have been essential to put it in the right place. Mm-hmm. It's also not about 25 psychiatric beds. Central Vermont Medical Center already has a 15-bed unit. You don't build two of the same kind of care on opposite sides of a hospital. Right. So the 15 and the 25 need to be together, which meant this was really a 40-bed unit on top of a full new emergency department.
I see.
Another line that's been out there a lot, I've heard it repeatedly in different accounts, is this this whole plan included the exorbitant-sounding rooftop gardens.
Oh, right, the roof gardens.
Yeah.
Yes.
So people need to understand, it was 20 years ago. I was very involved in the then Fletcher Allen University of Vermont Renaissance Plan and the inpatient units that were part of that. Mm-hmm. It was the state, through its Public Oversight Committee in the CON, that ordered UVM, recognizing the emerging standard of care for psychiatric inpatient units, for patients to have a space to go outdoors. These aren't folks who are in hospital beds for a few days. They're stabilizing from a psychiatric crisis, often for weeks, several weeks, sometimes longer. Mm-hmm. So the ability to get outside and get fresh air and yet be in a secure location, not wander off to the mall, requires that kind of outdoor space. And if you're not on a ground floor, but you're on upper floors, outdoor space means that it's on the roof of the building below.
Yeah.
So when you hear rooftop gardens, understand the context.
It sounds like, I don't know, you'd want to have a restaurant and pub up there or something.
That's what it sounds like. Like it's this lovely, and that doesn't mean it can't be nice, but the purpose is clinical.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the important distinction. Yeah. So I think everyone involved in all the work is really disappointed that it wasn't viable. $150 million was not within the UVM network capacity, as it became clear what it would cost to do it right. But it's also important that the network is still totally committed to meeting this mental health psychiatric inpatient need.
And from what you understand, they are?
They are absolutely going forward. What they need to do now is develop a design that isn't an obstruction to the future master plan, but maybe can't move other pieces forward together with, and that's going to be a challenge. It is going to delay by maybe 6 months or so.
I wondered if some of this might be an accounting issue. In other words, I think folks understand if every 30 or 40 years or whatever, a hospital might want to build a new emergency department, because that's a part of the hospital. I mean, all parts of the hospital, I would think, get very heavy use, just traffic, people walking in and out.
And medical needs change. What you have to have available clinically in an emergency department is very different from, 30 years ago.
Okay. So all of that makes sense, I think, And you might say to yourself, okay, well, our local hospital needs a new emergency department. Meanwhile, we want to build a psychiatric unit at our local hospital as well. Could these have been presented as separate budgets to the Green Mountain Care Board, where they, the CVMC comes in and says, here's our budget for our new emergency department, here's our budget for the psych wing? They might add up to $150 million, but it wouldn't sound like in the headline that we're talking about a $150 million psych unit. You know what I'm saying?
I think you're right, except I think that really would have been seen as a little disingenuous, because if you divided them out and said, well, the psych unit's only going to be $40 million for these 40 beds,
yep.
But if the construction is dependent upon the new emergency department, mm-hmm. to say, well, this is only this much, it really, I think they'd be accused of, kind of trying to pull a fast one.
Hide the ball or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, and I could imagine that actually if you're going to have a 40-bed psychiatric unit as part of your general, what was a general use hospital, you're going to have a slightly different emergency department, because you're going to be admitting people who are in psychiatric crisis along with the people who are, you know, having heart trouble or whatever.
Well, that's right. And you're going to be, they do that now, but yeah. You're going to have increased volume.
Right.
And it's very very important that different specialties, they do have a different cardiac care area than where you get stitches for the wound.
Yep, yep.
And you need an area that is specialized for people in a psychiatric crisis. Absolutely. And we did a lot of work on that plan in the emergency department to make it the best patient movement, accommodating different clinical needs. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of work done in the emergency department design as well as for the inpatient units. And I think
I've been up there I've had experiences where it seemed as though there was a lot of overlap, shall we say, between... you would have situations where somebody was getting treated for, you know, think of any sort of standard medical procedure, and there would be a psychiatric crisis sometimes going on in the next bed or right down the hall or whatever.
But that's right. And just like you wouldn't want to be there for your broken arm and have right next to you this crash team and all this huge activity over the patient with a heart attack.
Yeah.
Also don't want to be there with your pneumonia and feeling awful and having a person extremely distressed in a psychiatric crisis.
Yeah, yeah,
you don't want
yeah.
the kids screaming bloody murder getting stitches,
yeah,
you
yeah,
know, to
yeah.
be next to your elderly. So you do need to plan an emergency department.
This is real life here, folks, yeah. in our hospitals. It's really, it's quite an environment up, you know, in several, many of our hospitals that, and it's tough on the people who work there, and I hit my hats off to them because it's, it is.
Very much so.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not good for staff. It's not good for any of the patients, including people in a psychiatric crisis.
All right. Well, we are fast approaching the top of the hour here, which means we're about out of time. Just very quickly, next steps here.
Back to the table with all of the same stakeholders. I'll be there to really work with how do we move forward. How do we move forward with this effectively without doing something that's going to interfere with the slightly longer term, but coming right up on it needs to create a new emergency department and other replacements. So
yes.
We still don't want them bumping against each other as plans. We mm-hmm. want good planning. Unfortunately, it can't be a plan that all works together from the start.
Ann Donahue, State Representative from Northfield, thank you very much for joining me this morning.
Thank you.
We are, as I mentioned, fast approaching the top of the hour. That about wraps it up for this week's Dave Graham Shows on WDEV FM and AM. And stay tuned now for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio. And thanks for joining us all. We'll be back Monday morning and bright and early. And talk to you all then. Have a great weekend, everybody.